Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Quintessential Listening Poetry, a different kind of poetry call-in show. Tonight I am joined by acclaimed poets, Xenia Pinchback and Jackie Oldham. Lynn Biddy was also scheduled to join us tonight, but due to circumstances beyond her control, she will be unable to appear on tonight's program. When we think about poetry, we think about life and our own lived experiences. Lived experiences are the stories that people share about themselves and the world around them. It's primarily their point of view. So tonight, with the two poets who will be with me tonight, Xenia Pinchback and Jackie Oldham, we'll discuss lived experiences and the importance of having your own distinct point of view. Tonight, we'll start with Ms. Pinchback. Xenia, are you there?
I'm here.
All right, fantastic. You can read about Xenia on the episode information page. All right, Xenia, let me ask you a couple of questions before we begin this journey.
Okay.
What sparked your interest in becoming a poet or your love of poetry?
My love of poetry, my dad was a composer and a songwriter, so I grew up literally at his feet in his studio while he was writing and composing music. Oftentimes, to give me something to do, when I got restless, he would give me a sentence and tell me, hey, you know, what can you rhyme with this? Or what can you rhyme with the end of, with this verse? So I suppose that was my introduction to poetry. I don't really have a definitive, like a light bulb moment where I decided that I wanted to be a poet.
Yes.
Sometimes I'm on the fence about whether or not I'm a poet, and I've left poetry for years, and I just returned to it about a year and a half ago. So I think it's probably just been the influences of being around creative people as a child, and that just being the way that I tend to express myself best.
All right.
Poetry, photography, something creative.
Great. Well, when you think about poetry, why is poetry important? Why is it important in today's society?
Poetry is nuanced, even more so than prose, I think. Poetry captures a snapshot. Sometimes you need to tell a story, and sometimes you just want to paint the story. And I think, for me, poetry just, it captures a snapshot, and it allows you to give that to the reader, give it to yourself, maybe. For me, that's what poetry is. There are times when I might sit down to write something, and sometimes it just there's no other way for me to communicate it. For me, poetry forces me to maybe distill things, really weighty topics, things that are really heavy or things that are maybe hard to process, poetry forces me to sit down and kind of wrap it, maybe put it in a corset and make it work, make it behave. And it makes me take a lot away from it. So I can't put everything in it. I have to take away. I have to strip it bare and present it, lay it out, and sort of let it be.
Well, when you think about your work, your point of view, what are some of the predominant themes that you write about?
Oh, gosh, how horrible is this? This will be illustrated in the pieces that I'm reading tonight. I'm writing a lot now about death, about gratitude. Those two things may seem kind of in opposition to one another, but I don't think so. I'm newly in remission from cancer, so it seems that I am excavating, just kind of siphoning the joy out of the mundane. And before I was diagnosed with cancer, I would never write about death. It's something I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. I wouldn't touch it with your hand. And now I'm looking at it and I'm kind of walking around it and experimenting with it. So death, water sounds really weird, but I've written a lot about water lately.
All right.
Just how water can take form, how it's quiet, but it can also be raging. I think when you think of strength and you think of anger or danger or excitement or life, you think of fire. And I'm kind of looking at it from a different space. I live really close to the water right now, so I'm seeing how the water is both friend and foe, how it's strong, but it's gentle, how it cleans and it can purify, it can, you know, give birth, but it can also as well take life. It can also destroy. It can drown. So a lot of water, a little bit of death, and a lot of hope, hopefully. So that's what I'm doing right now.
Well, it sounds like you've had opportunities to share your work in other places. Am I correct?
I've been reading more in the past year, so I've been really lucky that opportunities have just been afforded me to read, and I appreciate it because I don't think I'm the greatest reader. I'm not the worst, but I'm not a performer, so reading is always a little iffy for me.
Yes.
But I think I've been so blessed and so lucky in the past 18 months that opportunities have just, you know, appeared. People have reached out to me and asked me to read. I've lucked upon or found opportunities and reached out, and something I wouldn't have done a few years ago. So I'm kind of getting my reading legs about me. So hopefully I'm getting better.
Well, what do you think would be or is the relationship between your speaking voice when you go out and share your lived experience and your written voice? Or have you had an opportunity to make the connection yet?
So here's the thing. Being the daughter of a musician, I was born with this voice. I kid you not, I was probably 2 days old crying in alto. So my dad always assumed, you know, he was a songwriter, he's a musician, he's like, oh my gosh, I've got this, my firstborn, she's going to be able to sing. And that's not the case. I can't sing. But I have this voice that's kind of, I think it's kind of intrusive, and sometimes I think it's aggressive. I'm not necessarily a fan of my voice. I'm not a fan of my voice. So I think my writing is a little different than my voice, my speaking voice. And I think when people hear me read it, it sometimes comes across differently. I'll workshop with other writers, and we'll be struggling or working out a kink in a piece or something, and then I'll read the piece, and they'll say, okay, when you read it, I understand it different. So let's go this way with it, or maybe let's work on it here. So I'm trying to bridge the gap between the way the poem sounds in my head and the way the poem sounds to the person listening to it when I read it.
All right.
If that makes sense.
It does make sense. It makes a lot of sense. Well, without further ado, Ms. Pinchback, you're on.
Okay. The first piece I'm going to read is How to Shave Your Head After Chemotherapy. Tell yourself, this is not hair. This is lips pursed so only a little prey squeaks through when the faith has left you. This is Mr. Curtis blowing the reefer smoke from his mouth into your mouth. Your mom in the foyer doing a bump while your baby brother lies curled at your feet, dreaming. This is not hair. This is lips pressed tight so only a little cry leaks through when the moon is soot blacking out the sun. This is a lava bubbling across the surface of the light skin and soft curls, Mr. Curtis says, will protect you from the ire of white folk as he is pressing the reefer smoke onto your tongue with his tongue. Your mother in the bathroom doing a bump. Just one more, I promise, while your brother awakes apparitions curled at your feet. This is traitor, pinning to the line best allowed to mold in the dark, rest quietly beneath a cleverly placed center part like thatch of balding scalp. This is a red sequin dress, strobe lit and slinking across your mother's petite body, the most beautiful, smart woman in the parlor with other beautiful, smart women. Sweet with Chanel No. 5, cocaine on grinning gums and acrylic nail tips, and you in the sleeping room, powder blue polyester school romper pulled down to your ankles, belly pressed to a window, staring out over the hills, and maybe even the Hollywood sign if you look far off to the right, he says each time. But you are only 8 years old and short for your age and see nothing rising above the darkness interrupted by flashbulbs as Mr. Curtis makes pictures of you, reefer smoke and ether in your brain. You are a babe in Tinseltown, and this is a heavy chain to a rusted anchor worn crossbody like playing dress-up with your mother's pocketbook. This is making your nerves bad, snaking beneath the surface of the light skin and soft curls, Mr. Curtis says, will protect you from the calamity of blackness. This is hand, foot, and tooth fighting for purchase on rock with no promise of a ledge. This is shame, a marionette doll stuffing a lava oozing from its seams, limbs jerking to Parliament funkadelic long playing record through a haze of Mr. Curtis reefer smoke and your mother's bad math. How many free dime bags moored to your 8-year-old body? This is a knock at the door in the thick of night announcing the rent has come due. What do you owe? What do you own? this is not hair. This is your mask askew. The next piece I'm going to do is try for something a little lighter. Water, the year of Cancer. Your hair, like ribbons of silk, black against the horizon. On the first warm day of spring, we stood at the shoreline in Hull, pants tucked into our duck boots, braiding seaweed spat from the mouth of the tide. My feet, like hot stone, sank through the shifting sand and I fell, cold water rushing the length of my body. You plucked me from the undertow at the start of what in the coming weeks I would call the season of my drowning. We wrung out my sweatpants, stuffed clamshells deep into our pockets, and drove home with the ocean and our socks. This next piece is a poem I wrote years ago, in 2010 actually. I wrote it about my mother when my aunt was dying of cancer. My mother is a retired hospice nurse, and she moved in with my uncle and his wife to care for my aunt those last few months, those last 2 months. And I remember calling my mother one night and asking her if she was afraid that she might, if she was afraid to be in the house alone with my aunt so close to death. My uncle was working in the evening, so my mother was there alone with her, with my aunt. And my mother told me how when you care for someone, or when you're a caretaker, that you begin to feel the rhythm of their heart, their breathing. And I learned that, or I understood that better years, 2 years later when my father died. But at the time when she told me that, I didn't really understand it. But suffice it to say, she was not afraid of being there if my aunt transitioned that night. And I wrote this piece then as an essay, and just recently I rewrote it as a poem. The title is Pallbearer. They are singing a song for the living, lamentations to the burden and gift each new day on which your name is written. A song full-throated at once harkens back to the warmth and lush florals of youth, your lily of the valley, your sandalwood and myrrh, your tangerine sweet and sun-kissed skin mapping its lyric. A ha-ha-ha, hee-hee, song of merriment by ritual feasts and ornamentations spirited, bearing of children and fires lit against the sky to mark the victory of their births. They are singing a song for the dead, tongue heavy with prey, knowing night falls, a dense fog lingering underfoot or gale swift at your back, washing and redressing the day, a pulse thready beneath its fingers, throwing open the window and its trimmings, a tide quaking beneath its lyric, sing you onto the morrow where there is no lament. this next piece, I wrote about my father. It is, and I apologize for having the introductions. I think the rule is that poets aren't supposed to have these long, illustrious introductions, but my apologies. When my father died in 2011, me being the writer in the family, I was supposed to write his eulogy, and I was unable to do that. I wasn't able to write his eulogy or his obituary, and it actually was the event that led to me not writing poetry for years. At the time of his death, I went completely silent. No matter what I did, I couldn't write, I couldn't find words, and I just started taking photographs. And I wrote this for my father right after, I'd say 2 days after Aretha Franklin's death last year, and it is the first or the closest thing I've come to any eulogizing my dad. And this is Traveling Mercies. Quote, Aretha is the last sound they hear before dying, end quote. Ta-Nehisi Coates, from Between the World and Me. Ain't no way I left town without the pitch of her yell, the swell of her moan, a river through my speakers, after you squatting beside my car to place hand to fender in prayer, the road Denver to Nashville rise up to greet me, eyes gray and glinting with tears, told me goodbye for the last time. After craft beers and breakfast in lower downtown, you said, ain't no way these gastropub biscuits taste better with seeded black jam than the art of your scratch gravy. Bleached flour over grease drippings, scrambled in cast iron until almost burnt black, before seeping in water and whisking together slowly, slowly like the night rolling into dawn, like the morning I awoke at your bedside, reclined and counting the seconds between your exhalations. And ain't no way in that lingering silence, after the final rush of air left your lungs, filling the room with your exit, I didn't bargain for time enough to pray you safe passage, my tongue a vinyl groove repeating, call me the moment you get there. Probably hear me rustling papers. This next piece is kind of fun. It was inspired by a poet friend of mine, whose work I admire, and I admire her separate from her work as well. This piece is a short piece, but I think it's a lot of fun. Presumed dead, Oz expatriate claims squatter's rights in Kansas. I am want and rain, wall cloud a pulse against my seat bone, stirring the river of feral rams, limb, sap, and heifer's claw, a putrid debris on my hat's brim, three heel clicks from your door, poppies, red like tongues swelled hot with curse, a bouquet under my fingers now. I am sunflower plucked bare, a storm cellar spun up, gold brick dusk and atonement. I am both the glint and the eye. Tin woodsman's axe up sleeve of yellow slicker, loose sequin, ruby slippers. And this last piece is a prosy, kind of a, I suppose it would be a prose poem. While sorrow trickled from you like a spring, you mixed a lidocaine salve for my burnt skin and placed a basin of tepid water and lavender oil on the bed where I lay curled, head nesting in the crook of my arm as if repentant. You hummed the same song about divine grace, your faith unwavering as you did this work. At 69, your hands steady, you pressed firm on my skin, pulling taut the adhesive tape to undress the wound. And one by one, you soaked paper towels in the sweet-smelling water, washed and patted dry my falling away skin. When I winced, drawing my hands into fists, you slowed your pace and reminded me to expose the wound. Allow it to breathe. Every living thing needs oxygen, you said. And you, standing at the window, clumps of paper towels like wilted peonies in your grasp, whispered, I wish it was me. As if spoken full out, the words were embers and my body the sagebrush. But then you laughed, said I was too young to have cancer and old lady hands, your and your mother's hands, small soft lines that carry the perfume of cinnamon and lime long after the last mound of dough has been rolled out and folded around apples for pie. Slender fingers that pull plant from soil, leaf from stem, but just as easily smooth hair knots into lush coils. You are right. These hands of mine have never been new. We enter this world already holding our mother's stories. Thank you.
Thank you. What have you learned about yourself from being a writer, from being a poet? Who are you as a result of being a poet?
That's a good question. Who am I? I've learned what my weaknesses are, what my character weaknesses are. I've learned that I can hold a grudge for a long time, a lot longer than it's probably healthy. But I'm also learning of late that writing is giving me a space of freedom. When you get sick and you're afraid of dying and you're terrified of dying, there's a freedom that comes with that. And I think for me, the writing combined with that, it's allowing me to say things and to feel things and to do things. It's giving me a wide open space to explore. With those pieces, the few pieces that I read, the beginning piece or the first piece, the shaving the head piece, which is kind of a really intense piece, is the very first piece I wrote right after I got my diagnosis. And what I like about these few pieces, is the last piece is exactly it's sort of a polar opposite. Both pieces are about my mom. Both pieces are about my relationship with my mother. They're both very intimate pieces. But I don't know that I would have been able to see my own personal exploration of my relationship with my mother if I weren't writing it and writing it from an honest space. So I think poetry is growing me up, maybe. For the first time in my writing life, I feel like an adult and not like a, you know, tantrum-throwing teenager.
All right. Well, let me ask this one last question. When people hear your work, they usually want more. What's next for you as a poet?
I am working on I'm trying to pull together a collection of essays and poems that explore kind of intergenerational trauma from more of a recovery space, or maybe reclaiming the self and kind of realizing this is what happened, and this is where we started, and this is where we are. So that's what I'm focused on now, and I'm really excited about it because it's taking so much shape. It's coming out as fairy tale characters, as the tires on an automobile, a tree, whatever. And I'm just following it wherever it wants to go. So I hope it turns into something great. But for right now, I'm just really enjoying the experience of writing and experimenting and opportunities like this to read. And I just feel really a lot of gratitude that people want to hear it and want to read my writing. So.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much to Xenia Pinchback. Thank you. We'll be right back. Michael Anthony Ingram, I'd like to welcome you to Quintessential Listening Poetry. Our next poet is Jackie Oldham. Jackie, are you with me?
Yes, I am.
All right, it's great to hear your voice.
Thank you, same here.
All right. What sparked your initial love of poetry?
Well, interestingly, and similar to Xenia, I come from both a musical and word-loving family. I actually responded to music before I ever responded to words. But to answer your question briefly, nursery rhymes and a child's garden of verses is what sparked my initial love of poetry. I would listen to the golden records of nursery rhymes as a toddler, and responded to both the music and the words of them. And I've been really writing and playing music ever since.
Why do you think poetry has an important role in modern society?
I don't know so much about modern society, but I suppose this would be my answer. Poetry is like painting with words. You pick your words carefully as you would colors in a painting, and you evoke images with those words that you can't necessarily do in other types of writing.
When you think about your work, what are some of the predominant themes that are at play?
First and foremost is love and loss. That's something that I've experienced a lot over the last probably 10 to 15 years, and it has really informed my work. However, I also write about the world around me. I'm a native Baltimorean from Maryland, and I love my city to death. And that's one of the things I write about a lot, both the kind of nostalgia for the Baltimore I grew up in, but also recognizing where the city is now. And I also write about just things that strike me as unusual. One poem that I won't be reading tonight kind of combines some disparate occurrences on a single day. There was an earthquake in California on the same day that one of the planes in the Indonesia area crashed a few years ago. And somehow I managed to combine those disparate elements into a poem that spoke about the ironies of life and how, you know, just how strange the world can be and how strange life can be.
Have you had opportunities to share your work publicly?
Yes, I have. I actually gave my first public reading several months ago at a local event in Baltimore, and I was really pleasantly surprised at how well it was received. I've also performed in public many times as a musician, both as a singer and instrumentalist.
Well, when you think about that, what is the relationship between your speaking voice and your written voice?
I think my speaking voice surprises me, actually, in relation to my written voice. Now that I have started reading my works aloud, I find myself infusing more of a musicality to the reading. And I guess you could say I've always had something of a, not quite in an actor's sense of reading, but there's a theatricality to me.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now it's time for us to hear some of your work.
Okay. This first poem was written nearly a year ago, and it is a somewhat long but interesting memoir of my childhood in Baltimore in contrast to where we are now. And it's called You Don't Know Baltimore Like I Do. The Baltimore seen on the wire and homicide is not the Baltimore of my youth. The Baltimore seen in 2015 after the death of Freddie Gray is not my Baltimore either. Where you see crime and grime and defeat in people's hardened hearts and in the black eyes of decrepit rotting houses and empty lots, I carry within my soft heart the vivid memory of a time when all those houses stood tall and proud, filled with families, sounds of laughter and love, fussing and fighting, and smells of food cooking, spilling and wafting from open doors and windows. Plenty of corner stores selling fresh food and produce where the owners kept your family's credit in big handwritten ledgers. That store at Monroe and Mosier Streets with the neon sign used to be Burkham's Grocery. They ground the beef fresh for you at the meat counter in the back. Once, when I was little, I ate maraschino cherries out of a jar I picked off the shelf. Grandma was mad. She had to buy that jar. And I never opened another jar in a store again. See that empty storefront at the corner of Fulton and Riggs Avenue across from the CME Church? I remember my daily after-school stops in that store with friends to buy root beer barrel candy and baseball cards and glittery little girl rings for 5 cents. And the CME Church was known then as the colored, now Christian, Methodist Episcopal Church. I would head on down Riggs to my grandma's house on Payson Street, and after our homework was done, we'd meet up outside and play step ball, jacks, or marbles, or ride up and down the street on our bikes, or go skating on our Union Number 5s until we were called in for dinner. On summer days, we eagerly awaited the Good Humor truck or small carnival rides brought in on the back of a pickup truck or horse rides provided by A-Rabbers. My aunt or my grandma would walk us up to Branch 17 of the Enoch Pratt Library at Pennsylvania and North Avenue for story hour and a pile of books to bring home and read. Further along Pennsylvania Avenue was The Avenue, home to the Royal Theater, where so many black musicians and comedians came to play. I used to go with my cousins to Tommy Tucker's to buy handkerchiefs and stinky perfume as presents for my family at Christmas time. But the 68 riots after MLK was killed destroyed Pennsylvania Avenue, and the spot where the Royal used to be is now commemorated with a sad little marquee announcing community events and a bronze statue of Billie Holiday standing nearby. On Sundays, we sometimes walked and sometimes rode up Lafayette Avenue to church. So many of the houses up near Carey Street had gleaming brass handrails alongside their clean white marble steps. Over on Bloom Street at my great-grandparents' house, I'd hum, "Here Comes the Bride," as the nuns from St. Peter Claver's would walk down the street two by two. My first home, the Carver Apartments on Division Street, is now another burnt-out shell, even though it was on the National Historic Registry. Before it became my first home, it served as a Catholic orphanage, yet as an apartment building, it retained the cavernous and odd-angled hallways and a courtyard in its midst. The careless owner charged with restoring it allowed it to burn down instead. But in the shell of the building, I can still see where my mother would hang out her laundry on a clothesline strung between our window and a neighbor's. I even remember the time when my grandfather, my youngest aunt, and I walked past the house off Fulton Avenue and Druid Park Lake Drive, where a memorial to Freddie Gray now sits. We were on our way home from a carnival where we got silly-faced clowns that danced from a string on a stick and melting ice cream running down our arms. So don't try to tell me how broken Baltimore is, because I remember when it wasn't. The second poem is also about living in Baltimore, but it's from a much more modern, older perspective. The Age of Wisdom Lost. At the age of 64, I find I am a dinosaur, shaking my fist at the young, telling them what they ain't done to earn the right to shut me down. Squeegee boys in my face while at a traffic light I wait. Smear that filthy rag and you'll get sprayed fast. Don't you know I got wipers and fluid for that? Go to the local gas station store and some homeboy entrepreneur telling me I can't park in the lot because he has rented the spot to wash cars. Black business, he says with a shoulder roll and a grin. I tell him, that don't mean nothing to me as I march into the store, having parked in front of the door, a spot I'm not supposed to be. Picking up my items and slapping them on the narrow ledge with an edge, I ask the foreign counter dude, how'd you let these fools take over your parking lot? Counter dude smiles sheepishly, saying, they'll be gone tomorrow, Mom. To which I reply, no need for all that. You got a whole big lot. Just give them a smaller spot. Closing the door as I leave the store, I see I'm blocked in by a young girl in a silver car waiting to get out of the gas line. rolling her eyes out loud. I jump in my car, put on my seatbelt, start the engine fiercely and prayerfully. I maneuver out of my space between a rack of tires and the girl's bitter face as she inches her car forward to let me pass. What the hell's happened to this world, I fume, shaking my head as I pull out onto the road to drive home. And then I ask myself, have you lost what's left of your dinosaur mind? You could have been killed twice. But if I don't speak up, who will? A day later, I swing by the store again. The car washers are still there, but so are the parking spaces. The car washer asks, want your car washed today? Nah, man, I say, but let me give you my card. This next poem, called Life After Death, Love Never Dies, was written recently after the death of my mother. It has been 6 months to the day since my mother, Dorothy Ann, passed away. I still mourn her passing deeply, yet every single day she's left miracles for me to behold in her memory. The flowering plant given to me by a friend a day after Mom's passing still blooms, though it sits on my drafty kitchen window ledge. All summer long, and even well into fall, my roses flowered, proud and tall, though scraggly compared to Mom's lush bushes, which we bought and planted together 2 years ago. And two small white butterflies, named Ma for Madam and Pa Butterfly, appeared daily all summer long, both at Mom's house and mine, sometimes actually flying close to me. Gradually, I became aware of Mom's greatest gift to me, the freedom to be. Days and weeks of unbearable, empty sadness gave way to opportunities unimagined. Newfound friendships and renewed, deepening old ones. My voice, once tentative, began to take on an urgent confidence, born of all the wisdom Mom bestowed on me. My poems, once written for myself alone, I've read aloud in public. The stories of my life, impossible without Mom's presence, began to be heard. And the love she poured into me now flows through and out of me toward others. I greet my neighbors with a smile and hugs, and we talk a while. I go out with friends and families for parties, movies, and civic engagement. And I raise my voice, laugh, argue, and sometimes even lead. All thanks to you, Dorothy Ann. Thank you for giving me permission to fly. This next poem is called The Fringe Dweller. You know this type, the girl who won't raise her hand to answer a question in class, even though she knows the answer, hands down. The awkward kid who can't throw, can't catch a pass, and gets picked last no matter what team. The girl seated at the dining table for dinner while silently talking to God, while everyone else is talking to each other. The teen who will play that piano or guitar for hours, but will stop and walk away when someone else notices. You think she's shy. You think she just doesn't believe in herself. If she would just... I am the fringe dweller. I'm not afraid to dip my toes into the waters, mud holes, and swamps of life. It's just that I invariably fall in head first. And after nearly drowning in the middle of the lake, or gasping for air as I climb out of the mud hole, or pushing and cutting my way out of the swampland, I want nothing more than to tell the tales of how I got over the water, how I knocked the mud off me, how I wrestled that alligator in the swamp. As I sit on the porch in my rocking chair, laughing in the face of life and death. Last poem is called Home at Last. The act of reclining on the swinging two-seater porch, the act of reclining on the swinging two-seater couch on the front porch, with my legs propped up on two arm pillows and a cigarette dangling between my fingers, was revolutionary. I did not care what my neighbors thought seeing me outside, or how I looked to the Sunday drivers barreling down my street while barely slowing down for the speed humps that I signed a petition to get installed precisely for them. Newcomers and shortcutters invading my space. All that mattered was that for the first time in 24 and a half years, I was finally at home, relaxing on my front porch. Taking a drag and exhaling my smoke at the prospect of burning my mortgage in just 5 and a half more years. All that's left to do is to exorcise the ghost of all the uninvited guests whose belongings stayed behind long after the guests wore out their welcome. Clothes, toys, beer cans, and liquor bottles magically disappeared thanks to a professional junk remover. All that's left to be rid of now is the stuff I've accumulated while dealing with everyone else's lives. Receipts for bills long paid, performance reviews for jobs I've left behind, class notes and grades for a degree I never benefited from, scraps of poems and essays, paintings and drawings never completed. But I cannot let go of the books I've read, or the LPs, 45s, cassettes, and CDs I've amassed, nor the poems and essays I've completed, some published, nor the newspaper articles chronicling the idols who molded my worldview or the historical benchmarks of my lifetime. They are the mileposts of my life, the link to my past, even as I create a new mantra. Keep moving forward and don't look back. Thank you.
Thank you. What have you learned about yourself from being a poet or a writer? Who are you as a consequence?
Wow. Well, I have learned, number one, that I am much stronger than I gave myself credit for in my youth. And I have learned that there's a lot I have to say, a lot that's worth being told, and I'm finding worth listening to.
What's next for you as a poet?
I think what's next for me will be to, number one, do more readings of my work, and number two, to explore new themes in my writing. My writing so far, as I mentioned earlier, has focused a lot on my city, my memories of growing up, and I think now I would like to look more forward and look at the world as it exists around me more.
You know, I want to thank you very much for sharing your work.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to bring Tazinia Pinchback back in. Lynn Biddy, who's not here tonight, played a very major role in planning this program. So I give her kudos in terms of pulling the whole cast together, the two other poets. So what we'd like to do to honor Lynn is to share two of her works, one read by Ms. Pinchback and the other read by Ms. Oldham.
Okay. I'm reading Lynn's poem, Tremont Street Suppers. Nixon was president. We didn't yet see how we'd get rid of him. We were bombing Cambodia. We tuned in nightly to the war summary on WBAI. The men acquired draft deferments by various means. One of them, blind in one eye. Another saw a psychoanalyst twice weekly, paid for by his parents. All but us were unmarried, some coupled, some singletons. There was always flirting. There were assignations. Where young people found themselves, the library, the nature museum on High Ridge Road, the diner in town, the natural food store with the prototype electric cars lined up in the back parking lot waiting for the future. Frugal last-minute potlucks, the appetizer a shared joint, the main course invariably some vegetarian concoction from a counterculture cookbook. Dessert might be a large bowl of ice cream with a half dozen spoons stuck into the decanted mess of raw almonds we dipped into a saucer of honey before leaning back to savor the night's music. We wanted the evening to last longer than the workday, wanted love, wanted romance. We wanted to be made for each other. Even as the others circled around us, shiny, patchouli-scented distractions, we did not see for the danger they were to us, to our fragile, suspended tandem state. Thank you.
This next poem is also by Lynn Biddy, titled In Lewisburg, County Mayo, Thinking About Dublin. The smell of burning peat in the steady morning rain suggests a memory out of reach, something from years ago when I got the notion to drain my small savings account, head for Ireland once final exams were read, grades in, textbooks collected, accounted for. My chairman satisfied that the city of Stamford had gotten its due. I was 26, marriage in shreds, divorce papers drawn up. I was seeking a different self, a poetic self. I stayed a week in Dublin, wandering the paths Joyce describes. Each day I distracted myself from the hole in my life. Went to the Abbey, met an American actor, a minor figure on the Broadway stage, who took me to an after-hours place, frequented by the Dublin theater crowd. I could have sworn when we knocked and the actor whispered the password, the man who peeked out and opened the door was Milo O'Shea, the actor. And I drank Jameson's neat, sipped it slowly. In Boyle, County Roscommon, town of my great-grandmother, I wandered the cemetery, searching for the sheiky graves. The headstones from the days of the great hunger hid in the high grass. I rented a small red Ford, drove across Ireland, slowing down, stopping often for the sheep, accepting waves from old farmers as I shifted into first gear, onto the next village, stopping each night to find a room and perhaps supper, supper identical to breakfast, eggs and rashers. brown bread and white, tomato, tea, lashings of butter. I ate too much and drank the Guinness, which fattened me up. I outsized my waste. I was growing in my grief. Instead of wasting away, I came home a stone heavier, a bottle of Jameson's in my duty-free bag. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that is our show for this evening. I'd like to thank my special guest, Tazinia Pinchback, Jackie Oldham, and also to Lynn Vitti, who's not here, but we send her our greetings and we send her our love. Thank you and good night.